Carstensen. The details on it will show up later.
Take notes and go to write a story. And there just wasn't anything there. Len Frank was a splendid orator. But it was oratory, and there wasn't much in what he had to say. And it was not prejudice, but a feeling that he just was a lightweight for the job. I don't know.
Well, you look at his credentials coming into the presidency, yeah. And you're just astounded, especially after offering the post to Roscoe Pound.
That's right.
Coming, you know.
Yeah, you've heard that story,
yeah.
of salaries, that they went east to get a pound and came back with a franc and didn't know there was a difference in rate of exchange. You've heard that.
No, I haven't.
It's all, I think, Sellery, who hated Frank's guts,
yes,
too.
Yeah.
You don't have this thing running, or do you?
I think she might.
Oh.
Well, that's pretty common knowledge. If you read some permits at Wisconsin by Sellery.
Yeah, and his other one that he always liked was, it's the first time, second time, a virgin has brought forth a savior. Zona Gale went east and brought the savior in the form of Len Frank.
Whom she defended to the death, by the way, as I recall.
She held him.
Because
he'd been her editor.
Mm-hmm.
I think. Well, you've got a lot of lovely things to do.
The Frank presidency itself, that's just essentially what I'm working on right now. It's just fascinating. The whole thing on his hiring and his firing, and then the Snell incident and all those other.
And the experimental college,
yes.
With, who was that?
Michelejohn.
Michelejohn. Have you seen the little thing that, his name won't come for me. The little biographical sketch of Michelejohn in Dictionary of American Biography.
No, I haven't.
It's a very interesting thing. Michelejohn, who became the hero of academic freedom, etc., etc., ran Amherst as if he were captain of the ship. Could throw out any faculty. Faculty hated him. Tom LeDuc. Do you know his name?
I'm beginning to think we may have a reprint of that.
Which is an interesting thing, because we have that other picture of Michelejohn here, and a very interesting thing he carried on.
Yeah, it's. Have you read Larson's biography, Frank? What was your opinion of that?
Well, I knew Larson and liked him, and he's a half journalist. He picks up things and makes a good story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I was awfully enthusiastic, but I wasn't awful. I didn't want to denigrate it either.
I thought it was kind of ironic that one of the points that Larson made is that Frank could speak so well, but there was no substance, and Larson could write so well.
not
a great deal of substance.
Larson, a few years ago, he's a prodigiously energetic character. He found the army plans on how to protect the Dakotas in case of a war with Canada. You wouldn't believe it, or would you? Have you been in the army?
No, but I would believe it anyway.
He got hold of it and peddled it to the newspapers, and it was a three-day wonder. Can you imagine defending North Dakota against the Canadian invasion?
When was it written?
About 1910 or something like that. I don't remember the dates exactly.
How would you characterize Glenn Frank?
I?
Yeah, personally, from your...
I never knew him. And I read the transcript before I knew that we were not going to go beyond 1925. Mm-hmm. At some point along the line, when I was going through records, and I must confess that I was somewhat, I think, probably prejudiced against him, because in my slow-witted and unimaginative way, it seemed to me that he, if the transcript reflected anything, he wasn't a man of his word. He promised to devote full time to the university, and he would never cut off the speeches and the writing and so on that he was doing. And that kind of this prejudiced me against him again. And on top of that, Dean Celery, who was a tough old Scotsman from Canada, medieval historian here, was in retirement. He read all of our manuscript as the as we testified to him. I got fairly well acquainted with him. He's a man who was reserved but candid and kind of inflexible. He talked from time to time about Glenn Frank, particularly when he knew we weren't going to write about him. Then he said a few things, but with nice reserve on that Ferments at Wisconsin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Too much reserve, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that he probably also helped to prejudice against me. I make these two statements before I say, I think he was a lightweight who had no business being the president of the university. He had one idea, and it was a great idea, but not one to pull on a faculty. We'll establish an experimental college where teaching is done properly and where the curriculum is appropriate.
Just what the dean of LNS wants to hear, right?
That's right.
Things aren't prejudiced done well here.
And it was a pretty good, of course, it was a pretty good experiment. You've got a lot of information on that, but also it was the kind of thing you'll recognize. If you were writing a novel and wanting to use something like that, you'd hesitate about having a president stupid enough to prejudice the faculty against him by saying, you birds, particularly if you hadn't done any work as a president, had never been a teacher to speak of, only a preacher, you wouldn't have a president of a big university take steps to inflame the faculty against you, or would you? Would you use that in fiction? Mm-hmm. So they'd say, no, they don't get that far.
It's called plausibility.
This is an interview with Vernon Carstensen on September 20th, 1982, who you're in town for, 2 days, is it? And Barry Tyker is here, who is doing research on the two new volumes of the university history. And I'm Robert Smale of the Oral History Project.
Now we can talk.
I want to continue, just one more. This isn't where I had planned on going, but this is so interesting. You said that Frank's one good idea was the experimental college, but was that really his?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I'm really realizing that when he was editor of Century, he published an article by Micklejohn on proposal for an experimental type of school. So
probably not his, but don't you have to figure that if a president is bright enough to pick up good ideas and move with them, you have to give him credit. Mm-hmm. And if he is bright enough to get a very able guy to do it, and manages to do it without trouble, then he is pretty good.
Of course, if he's dull enough to antagonize the faculty on
that right.
Before he steps on.
That's right.
Well, did you read that thing that Celery said about the second time they met, or the first time he was at Frank's house for dinner, Frank took him into the study and showed him a dossier on all the major faculty members that he had a detective do before he came to Wisconsin?
I remember that. I wouldn't have been able to recall it. But yeah.
And Celery just said they weren't very complimentary, especially mine. I slammed them shut, and I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And I have a feeling that his opinion was being very strongly formed, that this man did not understand the academic mindset.
Somebody told me, it was also part of the gossip, that Glenn Frank was going to fire Celery as dean. You've heard that.
Yes.
He'd announced it. I think this was Otto, Max Otto, the philosopher. And Glenn Frank announced he's going to fire Celery. They all knew about it. A number of people knew about it. Wondered how they could stop it. excuse me, I'm picking up a frog. Sellery was invited to come up to the president's office from South Hall up the, to Bascom, which was the president's hall, the president's office. And I think Max Otto said he saw Sellery at 11 o'clock or something walk up the hill and wondered whether it went right. 2 minutes later, Sellery walked down the hill, and Max Otto, an old friend, called him to be prepared to sympathize with him. And apparently Glenn Frank, in the face of Sellery, didn't have the nerves to throw him off. Had you heard that
one? I hadn't heard that, but it doesn't surprise me, because one of the Regent's charges, Regent Wilkie, in his list of particular, bill of particulars when they fired him, said he is never able to do face-to-face what he has to do, you know, in order to run the university.
I wouldn't have had courage to fire Sellery either.
From what I heard, I would have never even invited him up to my office.
I'd have saved a letter and gone out of town for a week.
If we could move back to getting back to volumes 1 and 2 for just a moment. Could you just relate for us briefly the origins of your involvement with volumes 1 and 2 with Curdy?
A purely accidental and in some ways mad. I had to, it's a doctoral dissertation written on the history of the University of Iowa. Up to 1880, I really fancied myself as a frontier historian, but the chances came along to do the origin and early years of the University of Iowa. And at the time, there also was a promise that there would be 4 or 5 of these done, the Historical Society would publish the monographs. Awfully nice, attractive thing. I did that one and finished it in 36. And I think it was a pretty good job, and I think I had seen things in the history of the creation of a state university that nobody, I was probably one of the early historians to work on it. You know, we still had Muzzy, not Muzzy, we had the Felton Stanford history of education kind of
Coverley?
Coverley,
yeah.
I went away out to Washington expecting one day I'd hear about revisions and whatnot. And what I heard was the history department had a big feud with the Historical Society, and there weren't any of these going to be published. So that was that. I think I got a little abstract published, but that was all. The project went on to 20 volumes, doctoral dissertations and master's dissertations. During the war, I left college where I was teaching, little teacher's college in Washington, to work for the Quartermaster Corps. And while there, in 44, Curdy got started on this project with support from the research committee. And after he had 2 or 3 research assistants, and before he finished the first year, he was damn sure that it was going to take more than he could get, he and graduate assistants could do, to get it finished by 49. And Merrill Jensen, I don't know what the story is here, Merrill says he got hold of, that he picked up, had the Iowa people send him my dissertation, he read it, liked it. Merrill Jensen just came here, I knew Merrill quite well from Washington. Merrill said, I know the guy, he's got only one head, and apparently pretty normal. So Curdy then got hold of me, wrote to me, asked whether I'd be interested in coming to collaborate. And this was in the spring of 45, with the war running down. I was in Washington at the time. Scheduled to go back to Ellensburg, but the chance of working with Merrill Curdy, whom I never met, It was awfully attractive. Moreau came into Washington, we talked, and I agreed, and I said, this is kind of idiotic on my part. How did I know we could get along, work together? As it turned, and I agreed to come to serve as, I would be co-author, and probably do most of the scut work, you know, look after assistants and things of that sort. We came out, and I don't believe it, we managed to turn that thing out in 3 years. And I taught part-time Merle. Of course, I was working almost full-time in the history. Merle taught his full load, I believe. You know Merle Kirby,
yes,
of course. His seminar, his course. He had 6 months in India. And with all of that, he could, when it came to producing, he could do as much as I could full-time.
You mean writing?
Yeah, yeah. I wrote a little more of the book than he did, but...
How did you go about dividing, determining who was going to do what, and dividing your...
We got an outline and kind of divided them up. Things like The Mind of John Bascom, I couldn't have even come close to. Me, I did the stuff such as the legislative thing. Merle, they couldn't be bothered with how the legislature was teaching it, treating the university. I did... I think I did law school, did engineering, did some of the agriculture, did extension.
Did you work out the outline together?
We worked out the outline together, and then he took the chapters he wanted and I took the others.
How did you go about doing that? Did you do research before you did the outline, or did it just kind of emerge?
We had a staff of TAs, two to start with, I think, and then four and six, and maybe four. And we had, we set them to work. I'd had much more experience with this kind of thing than Merle had. I knew where the documents were and so on. Not where they were, but where what we ought to be looking for. Faculty records, for example, regents' records, departmental records, if any survived, college records after the colleges came into existence. They had no archives.
Mm-hmm.
We found some things, as you probably know, after we finished the damn thing. Mm-hmm.
We can get to that painful topic later.
Actually, some marvelous stuff. I did this chapter on the beginning of intercollegiate athletics. After we had finished, both volumes had been out 2-3 years, and I'd caught hell from the athletic department for... what somebody called the muted irony in those chapters, the chapter on the beginnings of intercollegiate athletics. In a ventilating duct in Bascom Hall, under the president's office, they were doing some remodeling, and they found half a bundle of records, including, would you believe it, the stuff of the 1880s, it's in the archives now. I think it's the 1880s and 1890s, that goes to the professionalism of track and baseball players. And the faculty was trying to control it, and the faculty couldn't handle it any more than it can now.
You mean you conducted your research and you neglected to look in all the ventilating shafts before?
Right.
Shame on you.
What we did, we broke it up. I'll take the legislative stuff. And that was the laws, and any hearings that we had, the House and Senate journals, special reports, all that was published by the government, by the state government. And then when the federal government was involved, which it was after the Morrill Act, we had that category of records. Then we had the local newspapers and the mass newspapers. I'm being too detailed on this because you see it, I expect. These categories of records. We had 2-3 fine collections of papers. Elijah Kies, who was a regent for a long time. Napoleon Bonaparte, Bonaparte, Van Schleich, and a fellow named Paul. All kept good records, the society got them. And what we do is assign a graduate student to a, we tried to work all these things simultaneous, kind of together, but assign one to the legislative, the state records, federal records, archive or manuscript collection, the faculty stuff, etc. And we had a weekly meeting in which we talked about what we were coming up with. See, we got pretty, we didn't get everything, but we did pretty well, I think. And your heart will break when I tell you, if you don't already know, that when we were at work, up in Bascom Hall is the secretary of the, well, I'm not sure what he was secretary of, the chap in charge of accreditation of high schools. Beginning in the late 1860s, early 70s, the arrangement worked out, there's a little set in volume one about the relation of the university to the high schools. If they got accredited, their graduates could come directly into the university without entrance examinations. The accreditation was worked out between this, a secretary of the faculty and the superintendent of schools would write in and say, could you send out somebody from the faculty to inspect our school? We can probably pay him a little by advertising a lecture. He'll give a lecture, and he would go out, give his lecture, spend the day in school, look at how they were teaching Greek, Latin, mathematics, geography, whatnot, and come back and write a report, which was submitted to the faculty, and the faculty would then approve that school for accreditation or whatnot. We had those damn things up there. I looked at a batch of them. I talked to somebody in education. Here's a really superb. Mm-hmm. All of these reports were filed. All you got in the minutes of the faculty was a reference that the report had been made. Some idiot secretary up there wanted new room for an idiot boss that she had, and took the whole damn bunch out and destroyed it. I think. You know, you destroy things, and they always sometimes...
Well, you know, I have an office in the education building. Perhaps I should crawl around the ventilation shafts and see if I can come up with it.
We'll be fine. After we got an archives, as you may or may not know, because mm-hmm. I was made member of the, I guess, chairman of the archives committee.
Yes, you're mm-hmm. held responsible for starting the archives.
You know, kind of, but I really didn't do it. What I did was to threaten to... I told Fred Herring, who was then chairman, that we weren't getting anywhere with the damned archives. And there had to be, we had to bring them together. They had a state archives under Jess Bell. I was going to write to the president of the university and say, inasmuch as the university is not interested in taking proper steps to protect its records, I hereby, or your committee, recommends that the university records be sent to the state archives. Fred Harrington, who's really the mover on this, Fred was delighted. He said, give me a day.
This was E.B. Fred was president.
Yeah, E.B. Yeah. Fred was president. And Fred went to Ingram. And, I don't know what he said, but apparently he said this madman Karstensen is going to write a letter that's going to be awfully embarrassing. We've got to cut him off. And Ingram said, well, let's give him a couple of... the equivalent of two TAs to start a survey of the records to go into the archives, and the library will be finished in a year from now and we'll have space. And Fred apparently had this in mind all the time.
Yeah.
All he needed was somebody. And we got Richard Kirkendall, who is now the Henry Wallace Professor at Ames. Mm. And another fellow, Rick somebody, who you're going to have to run.
No, I was just shutting my, yeah. My, it goes off on the hour.
I'll have to give you a chance to ask a question. We start them in the Ag Hall in tons of dirt, and there they found almost all of the records that went to establishing what is the, my memory gets a little vague on it. They, Russell and Henry were engaged in carrying on the national propaganda to get money for the county agent system, I think. Mm-hmm. And those records, it was Russell had bundled mm-hmm. them up, said important, and successive people had pushed them further and further back under the eaves, and they used the attic of Ag Hall for their nutrition experiments with mice and mm-hmm. rats, and some of them got away and chewed on documents with Kirkendall and his Rick Thompson. We never heard anything more from Thompson after he got his PhD. But the two of them spent a couple months up there. Kirkendall still remembers that this is where he got started. He'd come here without a grant. He did his PhD with Curdy. Well, I talked on.
Well, I have all afternoon. Yeah. I'm in no hurry. I need to know what your schedule is, so I can.
Did you need money for that, for those TAs?
Well, that was the equivalent of a teaching assistantship.
Yeah.
And we were bucking for anything we could get to support our virtuous graduate students.
When did you get the space?
The space was about a year later. Yeah. But mm-hmm. Jess Bell then undertook to direct these guys on what, there's an awful lot of stuff we didn't save, but they spent, I think they, a semester or longer, getting the egg stuff started. And then once we had space here, mm-hmm. then we went to, got the faculty, as much of the faculty record down in the archives as possible. Alden White was slow to put that down. The regents were, we went after the regents to put the presidential papers and regents' records. And initially, presidents, we didn't have much presidential paper before Adams, I think. There's some Chamberlain stuff and a little Bascom. But they were pretty leery about letting anything out of the cellar of Bascom Hall. Mm. Until they found, by golly, they had a lot more room. And it was a marvelous change in 10 years because at first you couldn't pry it loose. And by the end of that time, Jess Bell had set up the kind of relationship of providing service for the records, which the girls up in the offices often couldn't do. They wanted a document from mm-hmm. 10 years ago. Jess got that stuff under control, and once they found that out, they could barely wait for a year to pass before they sent it down.
So he was doing a good job.
Oh, he was doing a very good job.
Was that right in the basement of the archives? Is that where they moved in initially?
No, they're in the fourth floor of the library.
Yeah, where are they? Are they still there?
They're now down in the basement. They have an enormous shelf space down.
It's been how many years since volumes 1 and 2 have been published now?
You have it over there. I think it's 49.
It should have been, yes, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And then it was reissued in, 74?
Yeah.
Over the passing of the years, it's more or less of a retro.
Med school opened by about 1870. They had a grave snatching incident, which they traced to the professor of anatomy and two students in the anatomy class, and that was not viewed kindly. I'd gotten halfway through when the woman who ran the historical society called me up and said, Dr. So-and-so, who was a member of the first graduating class of med school, is in town. This is a long time ago. He was a man in his 80s. If you call him, you might have a chance to talk to him a little. And I called him, went over and talked to him, asked him about the grave snatching. He was a nice old doctor, still pretty sharp. He had all his wits about him. But he said, yes, he'd heard about it, but really couldn't help me. 3 or 4 months later, I got back on the damn thing and found he was one of the two students who'd been arrested. And I've always, every time bright young people tell me about oral history, I remember that one.
Let's go right to oral history, since we have an oral historian here.
All right.
Laura, why don't you address...
Well, it's both of our questions is, what use would you like to have made of oral history, and what use could be made of it now? You know that we have, we have about 230 interviews with people, mostly faculty, and some students, some administrators. And it's always been something of a question of what is going to be of interest to historians 50 years from now. Yes.
We were primitive. We made some use of a primitive kind of oral history, since we went around to all of the departments in which they had a senior member or a retired member and asked whether we could get a memoir on the department from that person. We didn't ourselves make notes. Although we did have interviews with some elder statesmen on which I took notes, or Merle Curdy took notes. And I'm not sure whether that was more or less, probably more efficient than if we'd taped it.
I imagine it was more efficient.
Because we had so much tape.
Yes.
Do you still have the tape made, or the record made by the Lighty of Extension? Does that mean anything to you? We heard that all of the, it's L-I-G-H-T-Y, I think, he was an assistant director of the Extension Division, had come in 1915 and was still around in 1946 and 47. We'd heard that all the Extension papers, the whole record of this, around in 1946 and 47. We'd heard that all the Extension papers, the whole record of this, which was the creative Extension Division of the country, as you probably remember, that all the papers had been destroyed. Later we found that Lighty had taken them home, put them in to come down to the archives and tape his recollections. His recollections were abundant. Mm-hmm. And I think he ran for something like 30 hours. And then he, whether they were transcribed or not, I don't know, but a fellow named Rosentretter, that has a history of the Extension Division here at the time. I think it's Rosentretter. Well, you don't have it, you'll pick it up. He did it for his doctoral dissertation and it was published by the university. Poor Rosentretter had to sit and listen for 30 hours.
Full-time job.
Yeah. But that was an uncontrolled kind of dictation. Lighty was asked to recall what he recalled about the establishment and growth and achievements of the division. And once permitted to, he was apparently capable of a 2-hour extemporaneous speech, and if he prepared it would be 4, so that this was not surprising. This doesn't quite answer your question. We interviewed Dr. Evans, who was kind of the founder of the hospital. And I think there may even be some slightly incoherent notes that I took over in the university archives. Evans we would like to have had on tape. He's an articulate, informed man who told us more than I got down, and we'd like to vet everything that he had. So that I don't answer your question. For the good ones, we'd have liked to have a full record for the bad ones.
What about the types of things, what types of documents didn't exist that would have been nice to have had that we might be able to catch through oral history. I'm thinking of something like student recollections on life on campus, inside stories from regents on events of the campus.
Fred, you won't get to Fred Heron to much all, will you? Fred was once going to prepare a memoir.
I've interviewed him quite extensively.
Huh?
I've interviewed him.
Have you?
A couple of times.
Yeah, he said he was, once told me he was going to have a dictator apparently pull account, his memory.
Yes, he would like to do that.
I hope you do get that out of him. Students, yes, if you could find student records, or student memoirs. Students are so abundant, and who do you know?
Yes, that's the problem I've always found.
Yeah.
How do you decide who is the typical student?
Athletics gets awfully complicated. How you write the history of a nation when you have trouble writing a history of a university, I don't know, but there are those problems. The student daily, which was fairly reused quite a bit, but how representative the stuff was that we took, I don't know. We had a few collections, we had a few student diaries.
Mm-hmm. And letters to
and
father.
A few letters.
Yeah.
We had all the papers of the the first archivist of the United States was an undergraduate here, and was an archivist when he was a freshman, I'm sure, because he had his parents keep every postcard and every letter that he sent back from the time he rode down to Madison on his wheel. And he sent the whole batch to us. We had it microfilmed, and we found very little of it useful because he told his parents about how much he had to pay for lunch and how much laundry cost, etc., that kind of thing. Yeah, if you can get the students, what's going to be would be awfully good too, if you can get the great scientific or other discoveries.
There's been some effort on that score. I mean, if Farrington Daniels, there's an interview with him.
And his papers are complete, I think, in the archives, aren't they? Carl Paul Link, Steinbach.
No.
Is Carl Paul Link still living?
No, he just died.
Oh.
I think fairly recently.
Mm-hmm. Steinbach and Link were the two big ones. Of course, Link has written rather imaginatively. His enemies in the Ag College told me about the discovery of dicumeran. Somebody in genetics also made a contribution that Carl Paul Link didn't acknowledge. They're very sensitive about those matters.
But that's not useful for this volume, do you think? Talking to people about their discoveries?
Well, you're going to pay some attention to... you're not going to cover all of them, but you're going to look at the increase, say, in the number of members of the National Science, the National Academy of Sciences, between 1925 and 1946. And you're going to pick up two or three. You might take Hart and the work he did on Cuprum, what was it? He developed an iron or a copper that could be used for anemia, or Elvium with his whatever his experiments were on pellagra, or that found a cure of pellagra heart, and Elvium, Carl Paul Link, whose contribution was terrific in control of blood clotting, and a few others. Maybe those won't be the ones you take, but...
The equivalent now, you mean?
Huh?
The equivalent now. That is, they're all gone.
They're gone, but you're going to have, you're going to do something on the growth of Wisconsin as a research institution.
We've been told very much. It's going to be
And the number invited to become members of the National Academy of Sciences is the crude index of the success of the quality.
And you're saying you'd then go and interview those people, for instance, the National Science Foundation?
Yes. No, I guess I was just thinking of if you could find any of them to talk about, if you found one or two of these people still living or somebody who could talk about what went into.
I mean, I just interviewed somebody who is Phil Cohen, who is in physiological chemistry.
Yeah, I knew Phil
and
Cohen.
Did you?
How well, is he?
He's just fine. Mm-hmm. He's retired, yes, and he's in things all over the place, Brazil and Mexico. I talked to him. He was a graduate student here in the 1930s, and I talked to him about how he worked with students, and a little bit about. But I didn't ask him, how did you go about accomplishing what you accomplished in your scientific research? Mm. Because, I mean, would you put that in?
I don't know.
Gee, I wish John was here. I could point to him because he's handling the whole part on research.
Some people have been at it, I think.
Maybe it isn't a very good idea. Maybe it isn't a good idea at all. Because if you can get the kind of outer dimensions which you get from the record, but then the minute you single one man out, you may append.
You're right down to the individual.
Yeah, and then you may append all the others.
Mm-hmm. In this case, it was what encouraged you? How did the environment here either discourage or encourage you in your research? And that was very interesting because you know what the medical school was like for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And the biochem department, is it still a great department?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is going to be an interesting thing for you to tackle if you want to. Whether you get testimony, Ingram would be a nice guy to testify on this if you would. We had at one time on the university two ingrown departments, largely ingrown. Economics, maybe one person with a degree outside of Wisconsin. And it was not a very good department. This Torrey Young came in to kind of revise it. And the talk would be, if you want to see a department go downhill, hire your own PhDs. Everybody knows that.
That's what economics did. Is that, you're saying that's what economics
did? Yeah, that's what people would say about economics. There was that wonderful occasion with G.B. Fred and Brittingham got together. Brittingham gave tens of thousands of dollars to establish a professorship in social sciences, one of the weakest department, and they named sociology, and it took 10 years before sociology would accept the money.
That's a new story. I mean, I know about the Brittingham money.
They said the weakest department. It was the
Bert Fisher and Bry Kerr
and Bill Sewell.
Bill Ed Sewell. Young. Several of the rest of us were active in the '50s to try to crack wharf, as we said.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's been the main subject of my interviews.
You've got a record over here. You know who set it up to open it to all?
Well, Harrington is what I understand, but I...
Mm-hmm. Ralph Nafziger and I, you can find the records over here. I got a copy of the charter, and sent it to Ralph Nafziger, who was chairman of the Social Science Division, with letters to E.B. Fred and to Baldwin and Elvium, saying, you know, there doesn't say anything about restricting research support to the physical.
I didn't know who'd done it.
Physical and biological sciences. You'll probably find a copy of the letter over in the archives, if because there were enough sent. How come we don't share in the money? It was out of that E.B. Fred began to work toward making it possible to share.
E.B. Fred?
E.B. Fred and Elvium, they were a little embarrassed. And
Slip away.
Well, that's interesting. It's the story is all in the Nafziger and E.B. Fred, and I think there might even be some of my papers over there on the Social Science Division. That was the beginning. And it relates to restricting the income from WARF money became available for social science research. But at some point along here, E.B. Fred was complaining to Brittingham, as I got the story about these social science people were bitching about they're not having enough money, etc. And Brittingham said, let's give him a professorship, I'll put up the money. It wasn't large, you know, 50,000 or 100,000, something like that. This is of a Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon. They got Bob Taylor together. They worked out a news release, which in effect said, Brittingham is giving another gift to the university, something to strengthen one of the weakest departments in social sciences. It might not have been quite that obvious, but that's the way it was interpreted, and then went on to name sociology.
Actually, it was Guy Orkut and it came in economics that they used that money for, as I understand it.
I thought it was another numbers man in sociology. Well, it doesn't matter.
It could be a different, we may be talking about two.
Yeah. I drifted a lot.
That could be very interesting.
Yes. You're not leaving oral history yet, are you?
Oh, did you want to ask
about oral history? My feeling about oral history is that the best it can do is to point to places that you should then go into the archives and look.
I think that's right.
It can.
And you better always check the data, because I know my memory is not to be trusted. Freddie Harrington's ought to be trusted more than mine, but most people will make mistakes of one kind.
This merely ties in with the fact that there's a lot more information in the files now than there was.
There is so doggone much the film of having any more to deal with makes you shudder, doesn't it?
I'd
stay with Ride with your statement on oral history.
That it points that it can
point
to
it can highlight file. Certain things.
Yeah.
But
yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. When John and I had lunch with Professor Curry back at the beginning of summer, we asked him if there were any things that we should be aware of and we should be looking for when we research volumes 3 and 4. Any kind of hints he could give us on issues to be aware of, etc. And he named 3 or 4. For example, he said, look at the Wisconsin idea and see what happened. See what happened to that. Look at the sense of faculty and academic community and see what happened to that over time. Look at the whole thing about political intervention and the role of the legislature as it relates to the UW administration. Based on your own experience on this particular time period, 1925 to 1973, is there anything that you could name right off that we should be aware of that might not be real obvious in the records? Any themes, anything like that?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Murrow told you. on the one of the things that might be interesting, I don't think it's awfully important, what might be interesting for you to be alert about, and that is the way in which La Follette and the Progressives and the Wisconsin Idea and all the rest as symbols came to be kind of sanctified by people who really didn't agree with any of them. When Rennebaum was governor, he could cite, or his speechwriters would cite, the Progressive Wisconsin, Wisconsin Idea, and the La Follettes. You probably remember that.
No, but
in protection, in justification and support of whatever his program was. Mm-hmm. When he didn't support any of them. But the it's the way the Lincoln, all Republicans have had to get right with Lincoln. And Democrats, I suppose, with Jefferson.
Or almost the way Reagan was quoting Roosevelt earlier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's not awfully important, but it's worth looking at. The you're going to have a very interesting thing. I think I've never known quite how to handle this. On the one hand, the university, which looms so very large by 1915 in Utah. There's talk in the national magazines about the university that runs a state, etc., and its work benefits the whole state. It's beneficial. Discoveries reach out and touch the whole state. On one hand, the university is celebrated and continues to be celebrated as the kind of great secular cathedral for Wisconsin. You get that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you get a lot of people who want to attack the university. And you never quite know which is the serious phase. Who's the sociologist here who is under investigation? Fine old guy who caused a lot of trouble with the teens and the I should remember his name. Ross.
Yeah.
Ross. He was investigated by one of the legislatures, one of the legislative committees. They thought he was a red radical. And Ross put on a great show. And everybody loved it, apparently almost everybody, except the troglodytes who didn't like it. He was called down to the legislature to be interrogated about his ideas. And he brought all 32 volumes, you've heard that story.
Yes, no, go ahead.
Down there, and they wanted to ask him about his ideas, and he said, which ideas? That's the story you heard.
Yeah, I've heard, yeah. Heard something.
Yeah. Now, which is the investigation the serious thing, or is the great approval of Ross? There was an immense approval of Ross. For his outwitting legislature as a university professor. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether what I'm saying is breaking clear.
Well, no, there's that delicate balance there.
Yeah.
Who's on first kind of type thing.
Yeah. And there's the respect that runs almost along with the university is something to attack.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have to defend the freedoms that go along.
Right.
Well, there's a story that almost seems to sum that up. Remember when the Red meeting was broken up on campus in, I think, 1935, a student meeting, they had a communist speaker from out of town.
Yeah.
The jocks came after a football and threw them in the lake. And what the jocks were doing was buying what the media had been saying and what the legislator had been saying about this being a Red institution, et cetera. And they wanted to show that what they did to the Reds. And as soon as they did that, the very people who had been criticizing the Reds on campus came out and said, you can't do this. This is the freedom of speech.
Right.
And so
right.
these poor jocks were kind of caught on the horns of that dilemma. And kind of did what they thought people wanted them to do, and then got crucified the next day for doing precisely that.
Another thing Well, you've looked at the plaque, and you probably have, if you haven't encountered, you will encounter Ted Herforth's little essay on the sifting and winnowing plaque. Have you seen
it? I haven't seen the essay.
There is a plaque. There is a an essay that a fairly conservative insurance man here in Madison wrote about the plaque. Those magnificent words that thrilled him and cheered him. Now this is a nice conservative Republican insurance executive. God, he used to telephone me. He liked purple prose too, and he had a lot of it. But he'd telephone me and want me to read his latest paragraph. He finally wrote about, I think it was around 150 pages, and wanted the Regents to publish it. He'd also been handing over a few $1,000 a year to the Regents for Herford scholarship awards in memory of his wife. And what do you do with a, and he was also thought to be loaded with money. Turned out he did have $500,000 or so and left a large chunk of the university. What do you do with it? With somebody who's admiring your institution, I think it'd be nice if you published his essay celebrating the plaque, how it came to be, etc.
At least he wasn't attacking it. That would be
embarrassing. Oh, no. Well, they got, I think Irv Wiley signed up to edit it and reduce it so it's maybe a 30, 40 page thing. Burford screamed at every sentence that had to be sacrificed. But here's a wealthy, conservative, Republican business executive who is celebrating that hunk of metal up there nailed to the basket hall. In the period after World War II, if you go back on the history of it, the Regents were out of their minds with anger at those impertinent young whippersnappers who tried to embarrass them by handing him that plaque in 1914. Did you know that about
him?
It was handed as a criticism of the way the Regents had conducted their business. Because they had thought of firing Ross, they made Turner so unhappy, he went to Harvard. They were doing a lot of things, 1910, 11 in there. And it was the class of 1910 that got money, I think in 1915, instead of putting a stone on the campus or something of that sort, they decided they would, La Follette admiring public relations guy suggested him. They would take that phrase out of Adams's report on the Ely tribe, put it, cast it in bronze, and give it to the university. Now, my sequences have gotten vague on it, but it was quite a dust up. When they first made the plaque, the Regents declined to accept it. Then the class, I think that was, maybe they made it as their graduation present. They came back 5 years later, and by God, the Regents were going to nail it to a building, or they were going to buy 2 square feet of land down on State Street and erect it at the entrance of the university. Well, Van Heist worked it out so that they, and the students said 5 years later, they really hadn't intended to criticize the Regents. All they'd want to do was to call attention to the glories of the university. So it got nailed to Bascom Hall. But you see, this was the part of the La Follette progressive, disruptive influence, an attack on the conservatives. 30 years later, the plaque becomes something that all the conservatives celebrate. Mm-hmm. Now, what the hell is going on here? You see, well, you're interested in a lot of those things.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think
the way Ronald Reagan, you know, would not interfere with academic freedom when he was governor of California, mm-hmm. and they had all the troubles around Berkeley, he wouldn't. And in that, he'd like to string it all up, I suppose, mm-hmm. but he didn't.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to fiddle around and see if I can think of anything else for a moment on this, the big issues of the period. I think the Wisconsin idea, that's one that'll give you troubles, I expect, and a lot of fun, because it kind of can be used both by the devout and the sinful, mm-hmm. to cover all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I read an interesting statement this morning by Regent Wilkie at Frank's dismissal hearings, and he said that he didn't mention the Wisconsin idea, obviously, but he said one of the charges against Frank is he had just let teaching go. I think the phrase he used is almost something like to hell in a bucket. And that we all know that the main purpose of this great university is to teach undergraduates and to teach them alone. And it's nice if we can have a few famous researchers around here, but it's teaching that's number one at this university. And he emphasized it over and over and over again. I thought that's kind of interesting in light of the whole Wisconsin idea.
You got something that just came into my mind on this is when I came in 45, the idea, at least in history department and other departments, seemed to me was true, that the research was important and you had to do it and had to do publications, but your first obligation was as a teacher.
Now, is this something that you were told, or is this something that you just kind of picked up as...
Both told, and you also saw it. Paul Naplan, for example, who was the big... the hippopotamus of the big... the most powerful man in the history department, would never miss a undergraduate lecture. Hmm. And he himself, I think, read many of the papers. He interviewed every student in his big course in British Empire once a semester. And he apparently had one of these memories where he could see a student once, get the face and the name, and remember him 3 years later when he came mm-hmm. in. Bill Heseltine emphasize you never neglected your students. Teaching was important, and later it got so that, well, and we also had the mechanisms for it. To go away to a professional meeting, you applied for a leave of a day or two through your chairman and to the dean for two reasons. One, because you had to have your classes covered. One, to keep the classes covered, and the other, keep your industrial insurance operative in case you got in an auto accident. That's what they said. But the emphasis was pretty heavy there. And the question, you ask anybody in any of the state universities about the importance of teaching, I'll tell you it's very important. Where were you an undergraduate?
UWM.
Teaching is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Was it?
Yes, I would say it was.
Uh-huh. In all departments?
In the departments, in anthropology and English, the two departments I was involved with most.
At Iowa, where I was where I did work, they said that it was important, but nobody much cared if you know the chairman of the history department.